Right. Thank you, Phyllis. This is some work that I did long ago with Jay Rosenheim and Cynthia Sue, who's now at Cornell, and Jay is, of course, still at UC Davis. This is some work where we were specifically looking at the effects of pollen and nectar on generalist predators and other insects in the cotton system, and seeing what indirect effect that had on the spider mite. So we've seen this plenty of times in this session already. Many natural enemies of herbivores utilize plant resources. Pollen tends to be, if it's digestible by that particular insect, tends to be used for growth and development and egg production. And nectar tends to increase longevity. So in the cotton system, there's basically two sources for pollen and nectar. There's the floral source for the pollen and nectar. There's only one source for pollen, that's the floral source. And then you also have extrafloral nectaries for nectar. And you find these at the base of the square and also on the midrib of the midrib of each leaf and the base of the square here. Now, the year previous to this experiment, we had these populations of phytoseed mites that became really common, and the species is Eucias quetzali, and it had these amazing densities in cotton at many fields, and this is just one field where it's almost doesn't look like field data. Basically, this is our spider mite population. It built up, did its thing, but the Eucias, you know, kind of built up and just kept going, even after the mites crashed. And this genus of phytoseed mite is known to maintain high abundance, mostly due to pollen availability. So, in hope that we'd see Eucias again, and also we figured, you know, we'd get some good results from the other generalists, we did two experiments. The first experiment was a small plot, a small-scale open plot, season-long experiment, and the other one was kind of piggybacked onto that first one, where we had leaf cages. It was shorter term, and it was they were both factorial design. And the purpose was to see what are the direct effects of pollen and nectar availability on arthropods that utilize it. So how do the generalists respond to differing nectar and pollen availability? And also, what are the if the predators respond to these differing plant resources, how does this affect spider mite population dynamics? So in this experiment is not perfect, but it's what we did, and see what you think. I'll show you all the information. So to manipulate nectar, we used two near isogenic lines, DS119 and DS119, but with and without nectaries, and also DPL90 and with and without nectaries. And to prevent floral nectar or pollen from being produced, we removed any sort of square that was developed on the plant. And we did this throughout the entire season. And to manipulate pollen, we sprayed a suspension of pollen and water onto the plants about every 2 weeks. And this pollen was from a local beekeeper, so the plants that the pollen was from was from native plants. And the other treatment was sprayed with water to sort of control for the spraying procedure. Each plot was about 10 plants, and they were separated by about 3 meters of bare soil. And this is a picture of our experiment. This is at UC Davis Experimental Farm. And this would be a plot right here. And here's a close-up of a single plot. And this is a picture of the leaf cage experiment that I'll explain next, that was piggybacked on the first one. So once the experiment got going, it became clear that Eusius was kind of had a really good year, and it didn't show up the predatory Phaeacid mite. However, Aureus was the dominant predator, and that's pretty typical for this area. Aureus is always very common. So this is the population dynamics for spider mites. And it's a little messy, but basically what we found is where we put pollen onto plants, we saw a dramatic decrease in the peak level of spider mite populations. And nectar really didn't have any significant effect. And we analyzed this using a MANOVA and repeated measures of MANOVA. And here's, I'm going to throw these things at you and just to, you know, show you the data. And to help sort of keep things straight, here's, this is the organism I'm talking about, and this is the experiment. And the things that are bolded are significant or noteworthy. So pollen had a significant negative effect on spider mite populations as a main effect through the entire experiment. And also there was an interaction with time indicating the effect was stronger during the peak. And there's also a row effect, which was just due to the fact there was more mites on one side of the field than the other. This is the dynamics for Western flower thrips. They were much less abundant, but ubiquitous in cotton and many crops. And this is I'll kind of review this at the end, but it's a little tricky for thrips in this system, because thrips not only feed on pollen potentially and nectar, but they also feed on the plant. But some other work we did showed that one major protein source for thrips is spider mite eggs. So they could respond to increasing spider mite numbers also. And of course, they're a favored prey item for Aureus also. So what we see though is less dramatic result than the spider mites, but reduced levels of thrips in the pollen treatment. And this is the repeated measures MANOVA that looks at the thrips data. And we see there's, you know, at that peak of the mite population, there's a significant effect here, the time by pollen interaction. So significant difference. Pollen had a significant negative effect on thrips. And also one of the isolines, the thrips liked it more. So this is going to the Aureus populations. And basically what we found for Aureus adults, this is for Aureus adults here, is that during the August, and this data, instead of being done by leaf samples, this was done by whole plant samples done in association with the leaf samples. So we had a bigger area we searched for, you know, got a better sample. The Aureus really didn't respond to neither pollen nor nectar, the adults, that is. It was different for the nymphs. The nymphs were more abundant in the treatments that lacked pollen. So this was kind of like on our head, like, you know, what's going on here? But it's also important to remember that the thing that they really respond to is spider mite availability. So they were kind of responding to spider mites. And what we see, a significant negative effect of pollen. And this is for the August date. And a significant row effect. So basically these are the same two effects that were significant for spider mites. And if you put spider mite abundance for this date as a covariate, both these factors drop out. So it looks like the Aureus nymphs are tracking spider mites. So one interesting result that could help explain that spider mite data is this. If you look at the ratio of spider mites to Aureus, you see a significant lower level of spider mites or the ratio is lower, so there's fewer mites per aureus where we had pollen and where we didn't. And this is the table showing that, so significant effect pollen on the ratio. So this may be saying that when pollen is available, you could have a higher density of aureus with fewer spider mites. And to try to tease this apart, we additionally did a leaf cage experiment where we had more control. Because that open plot experiment, you know, if you're a winged insect, you could pretty much go from plot to plot. So for our second experiment, we manipulated nectar by using the same near isogenic lines as we just piggybacked on top of our other experiment. But it was later in the season when nectar flows were lower. So we also included a single drop, or about 250 microliters of honey as artificial nectar. And then we used the bee pollen again for the pollen. And for the spider mite manipulation, we first cleaned the leaf by brushing the leaf clean, and then we added spider mites to some, and first and second instar aureus, 4 per treatment, to others. And the duration of this experiment was for about 2 weeks, 13 days. And this just shows the treatments. So you have our 4, no nectar pollen, nectar pollen, and both pollen nectar. And then we had that in combination with aureus only, spider mites only, and then both aureus and spider mites. So looking at aureus abundance at the end of the experiment, what we found is the aureus really responded to the availability of pollen and to spider mites. And that really having pollen there was pretty much like having spider mites. So it was a very good food in terms of maintaining aureus abundance. And the other thing we found is when you had both pollen and spider mites, you didn't see any additional benefit in terms of aureus abundance. And this is the analysis of that. So pollen had a significant effect. If you look at F ratios, spider mites had a bigger effect. And there was a significant interaction between pollen and spider mites, which is basically telling you there's no additivity in this model. So So that was the abundance of aureus. This is the size. So this is the weight per aureus. So how big did they get with the diet they had? So if you look, leaf only, they were quite small. Leaf with nectar, somewhat bigger, but not significantly so. If you gave them pollen, they grew almost like they just had spider mites. So they're a very good food source for aureus. And this is kind of a funny result, and I guess it'd have to be repeated just to ensure this, but there was a significant interaction between pollen and nectar where nectar actually seemed to reduce the benefit that pollen availability gave to the aureus in terms of size. And I like to call this a junk food hypothesis. So they were feeding nectar and they didn't need enough pollen, so they stayed smaller. And this is the analysis of that. So for the leaf experiment, now let's look at spider mites. So if we look at spider mites and pollen nectar availability, I guess you wouldn't expect it to do anything, and there was no difference here. So the mites were the same across those plant treatments. Where you added aureus and you had the different pollen nectar treatments, You see a significant drop in all the spider mite populations when you add aureus. And you can see here the only main effect is aureus in terms of having all those treatments together. And this is just sort of showing the set that's just spider mites. So, you know, F ratios of tiny amounts, so no effect on spider mites. However, when you have aureus with pollen and nectar, you see that with pollen, the aureus seem to suppress mites more. And this is a significant effect also. So the availability of pollen improved the suppression ability of the aureus. And I guess kind of two different measurements, but there is a real similarity between the ratio that we saw of spider mites and aureus ratio we saw in the open plot experiment and the final spider mite counts in the cage experiment. So it indicates that having pollen available to aureus enables them to maintain spider mites at a lower level. And this was interesting. We didn't actually manipulate thrips in our cage experiment, but thrips are ubiquitous. They lay their eggs in the leaf tissue and they hatch out. You know, during the experiment, there's no way to remove them. So these are just sort of passive populations of thrips that were in our experiment. So where there was just aureus, we see low levels of thrips with some increases where there was pollen. You could see where there was no aureus, there was much higher levels of thrips, and that their populations were increased with the availability of nectar. And you also, where there was thrips and mites, or aureus and mites, the thrips did better also than when it was just aureus. And this is the difference here is somewhat complicated, because it could be because the thrips are feeding on the spider mite eggs as a protein source, so they're doing better. Or it could be because the predation rate by aureus is lower because there's spider mites to eat for aureus. And this is just the analysis for thrips. You see nectar significant, spider mites significant. Those are both positive for thrips, and then aureus is significant negative. So how am I doing, Phyllis? Okay. So in conclusion, the availability of pollen for aureus increased their size and their abundance, and increased and when they had both, their size was at least partially additive. They got a little bit bigger. And nectar didn't seem to have any sort of benefit to aureus. And pollen availability led to a decrease in the ratio of spider mites to aureus in the open plot experiment. And then for spider mites, we saw that there was pollen availability had no direct effect on spider mites, or pollen or nectar availability, which we'd expect, and that the addition of pollen increased the suppression of mites by aureus. And this could be because the aureus have more food and are able to maintain higher densities with fewer spider mite, because they have an alternative food source. And I'll leave it at that.
We have time for a couple of quick questions.
Yes.
I may have missed this if I came in late, but did you do any direct observations in the lab looking at the benefit of spider mites or spider mite eggs to Western flower thrips?
Yeah, I have some other work where we did lots of experiments, yeah, and you see a significant suppression of mites from thrips and a significant increase in thrips from eating mite eggs. So, yeah, there's strong pattern there, yeah. And actually, the suppression that you see of mite eggs actually can lead to yield differences in cotton. So it's pretty interesting.